The show you have selected will start directly after the next message.
If you are passionate about food and how it supports well-being and health, learn more. The Institute for Optimum Nutrition has been training nutritional therapists for 35 years on its highly acclaimed and accredited diploma courses. Start your new career in nutritional therapy, one that will make a difference and help others achieve their health goals. Train with the home of nutritional therapy education. Find us online and give us a call or click on the IOM banner on the UK Health Radio homepage.
Recovery Today on UKHealthRadio.com. Join me and my guests on this voyage of recovery and discovery.
Hello, everyone. Hi, I'm Jim Smith, and welcome to Recovery Today. And my guest this week is, it's kind of following the Scottish theme. The last show was, my guest was Hugh McKenna, and this week, my guest is Les Davidson, and Les also is hails from Scotland. That's right, Les, isn't
That's
it?
That's right, yeah, from Edinburgh. Yeah.
Edinburgh, you were?
Yeah, born in Edinburgh.
Born?
Yeah. Born in Edinburgh.
Yeah.
In 1954. Yeah. And, brought up there in the farming community.
Yeah.
My father ran a farm, small holding farm, and my uncle was a farmer, and my other uncles were butchers, and we were all definitely in from that farming community, all my childhood times were spent either on my farm or my Uncle Adam's farm up in Citra Hill. He had a big farm, big sheep farm up there, so he used to go up there for the lambing as well, which was great. Yeah, it was great fun.
So sounds as though childhood memories were fond experiences you had.
Yeah, yes, mostly they were, yeah. I mean, I think a couple of times, I can joke with my sister now, but my sister was supposed to be, I've got an older sister and older brother, and my sister was supposed to babysit me, and she used to threaten me with with violence because she would go out to see her mates or her boyfriend or something.
Oh, yeah.
She was supposed to be babysitting me. That was the only memories where it wasn't fond. But most of the rest of the time it was
fond. Yeah. So when did music come into your life?
It came into my life really. My mother tells me that when I was really small, something would come on the radio and I'd be playing with my toys on the floor.
Yeah.
Probably maybe 3 years old or something like that, I'm not sure. And she noticed I would start humming whatever melody had been on the radio.
Yeah.
And so by the age of six, I was playing instruments.
Yeah.
First of all, recorder. And then I was singing a little bit in a choir. And I've got an older brother, as I said, and my older brother played a bit of guitar and sang.
Yeah.
And I was very good at both of those things, my brother Tom. And my sister loved music, so there was music around, because of them. Mm. My mother had been a semi-professional dancer at one point.
Right.
And so, there was that atmosphere was there as well, which was nice because it sort of offset the farming community thing.
Yeah.
You know? So around about six, started playing instruments. And even by the age of about 10, I really wanted to learn instruments well. And I'd messed about with various other instruments. But I got around about the age of probably about 9 or 10, I got onto the guitar and realized that was the instrument that I really sort of had an affinity with.
And so
from that point on till now, that's what I've been doing.
Yeah, when you mentioned 10, that was for me, that was in 1958, and Buddy Holly came to my hometown. But I often joke about my Buddy Holly non-story, because my cousin came round for a haircut before going to see Buddy Holly, and I asked him to take me with him, but he didn't have a spare ticket. So I never got to see Buddy Holly, but it was his 60th anniversary recently, of his death, and he was quite remarkable. Right, and yeah. I didn't have a guitar then, but like I was really, because of the crickets and Ballyhollies playing, I too was going that way.
Yeah.
What about school, Les? How did you find school?
I enjoyed certain things at school. I liked the art classes, and I liked physics. I didn't really understand chemistry. I wasn't very good at mathematics. I was wouldn't say I was very good at English, but I had a great English teacher, and I enjoyed English. We had an amazing music school at the school I was at, but that was not that didn't really help me, because I sort of fell out with the music teacher quite early on, and spent about 3 years of my life at school standing outside the music room, because I was banned from going in because I'd had an argument about music, which in retrospect was, you know, probably pretty silly, but that's the way it was. That's what happened. Yeah. So I didn't really want to be there a lot of the time. My head was in music, and my reports said things like, you know, very bright, but doesn't work hard enough, doesn't do homework, you know, could do well,
could
do better. And if I liked a subject, I would really get involved in it. If I didn't like a subject, or I didn't understand it, because I couldn't, you know, cognize it, I just didn't have the ability or whatever, I didn't understand, then I'd just shut off.
Yeah.
And I'd stare out the window.
That's right.
Yeah. And wanted to be somewhere else.
No, I identify with that. It's funny, I mean, I was 70 recently, and you know, when I look back, the difference, the big difference is now I'm kind of open to all learning. I wasn't then at all, you know, like you, if I like something, fine, but if not, shut off.
It was too difficult, yes. I agree as well, because in the last 20 years or so, whatever, you know, I've been much more open to trying things.
Yes.
And, so attempting to do it, and if it doesn't work out, being, you know, going, well, at least I tried it, and I just, so if I made some effort to do it, that's a really good thing.
Sure.
Because it makes me feel better that I've actually tried to do something.
Yeah.
As opposed to just going, I can't do it, so therefore I won't do it.
That's right. Well, let's, you know, like all guests on this show, you get to choose three pieces of music that's been pertinent in your life, and your first piece of music we're playing now. It's introduce it.
Yeah, it's when I was about, I think I was about 12 or 13. I can't remember exactly the correct age, but I saw Jimi Hendrix play "Hey Joe" on Top of the Pops. And at the school the next day, all the people, all the guys that were into music were like, "Did you see that guy on Top of the Pops? Amazing guy, you know." So I could not afford to buy the "Hey Joe" single, but my brother did. And then I think I saved up for the first album, "Are You Experienced?" Yeah. And on that record, on that album, was a track called "Red House." Yeah. I was already very much into blues with Muddy Water and Albert King and Howlin' Wolf and Freddie King and B.B. King. So and lots of Sonny Terry, Brownie McGee, and people like that. So I bought it, and Red House just blew me away. It still does to this day.
Yeah.
Still one of the finest exponents of electric blues, in my opinion.
Oh, there's a red house over yonder.
That was Jimi Hendrix with Red House. What an amazing track, Les.
Classic, yeah.
Yeah,
classic.
Yeah. And an incredible musician. Right, so you were around about, you've got up to the age of about 13 at the moment, and we're 14. You're playing, but you're not really involved in a band yet?
Or? No, not quite. Although around about the age of 14, I started playing with a guy called Jerry Steed, who's a singer, played harmonica, and we sort of tried to get a couple of little bands together. We stuck together, and eventually, when I was about 16, I met some other guys who were a bit older than me. I also have to say that I met a guy called Morris Adamson when I was about 14, who was a bass player. Morris was three or four years older than me, I think, at that point. And we met in a sort of a church hall where bands were rehearsing. And we just hit it off musically. And he introduced me to some older musicians. And by the age of 16, I'd been asked not to bother coming back to school because you went to school in Scotland a year earlier than they did in England in those days, certainly. So I was definitely, my idea was to be a professional musician. And that was what my goal was at that point, and that's what I was trying to do. So I eventually got into a band about the age of 16, a band called Mother Flyer, which did quite well on the local circuit. We nearly got a record deal with Decca Records, but didn't quite get that deal in the end. Various other sort of, little things I was doing with some other musicians around that time. Three of us, the bass player, Morris, Andy Munro, the drummer, and myself, got hired to back a guy called Pete Atkin, who used to write with Clive James.
He was singing
a British tour. That was around about... So I moved forward to about the age of 18 or 19 then. And so we did a British tour. And that really made me go, I can do this, I think. And so the move to London was made around about that point.
That's fantastic. I didn't realise that. That was part of your career. Because I had those albums of Pete Atkins songs written, the lyrics written by Clive James.
That's right, yeah.
They were wonderful. They were so unique, weren't they?
They were very unique.
Yeah.
I saw him not that long ago, actually.
Really?
He was playing in the Pheasantry on the King's Road, and I went along and saw him, and it was great to see him after all those years.
Because Clive James now is pretty elderly, and he's quite ill.
Yes, I believe he is.
But he's still got that amazing wit.
Absolutely.
Oh, right. So, you were on your way. And what about, let's look at your drinking, or was it, at that time, was it so sure?
I mean, at that time, I can remember that when I used to, you know, go to a party and you know, we're going to a party really to get legless, I suppose, as most people, I suppose, were, indeed, yeah. Or at least that was my perception of it.
Yes.
I did get legless pretty much every time. So, but the thing was that I didn't drink all the time at that point because I was definitely dedicated to playing guitar. Mm. And so I'd have long periods where I wouldn't touch any alcohol at all. I even going to a party sometimes I wouldn't because I would, you know, my obsessional behavior, which, you know, reared its ugly head years to come, was I wasn't aware that that's what it was at the time. Mm. So I was so obsessed with practicing and trying to get better that anything that stood in the way was bad, and that included alcohol at that point. Mm-hmm. But when I did drink, I would drink to comatose state, without a doubt, even that early on.
Yeah.
And earlier, when I first had my first, you know, proper drink, when I was about 14, because the hotels in Edinburgh, there was no bars that opened on Sundays in Edinburgh in those days, and you had to go to the hotel.
That's right.
On a Sunday, but what we would do is we'd go with guys that were a little bit older or taller. Yeah. We'd sit in the garden, they'd go into the hotel, buy the drink and bring it out to us. So we would get drunk, you know. Mm. And the barman knew what was going on, but they didn't really care. As long as you didn't come into the bar and try and order a drink, you were fine.
You were okay, yeah.
Because they knew we were underage. Yeah.
So the tour with Pete Atkin, what came next? Did you stay with that band for a time?
Yeah, well, then I hooked up there's a guy called Pete Brown who wrote lyrics for Cream.
Mm.
I'd auditioned for him actually when I was about 16, but I hadn't got the job. But he'd seen me again when I was about 18, nearly 19, at the Edinburgh Festival. It's one of the beauties of being in Edinburgh was a festival, so a lot of people came into town. So
yeah, of course.
It was a sort of a shop window in a sense.
Yeah,
you know, your abilities, people would pass through and see you play and perform.
Mm.
So he had said, you know, if you're ever in London and you need a gig, so consequently I got in touch with him. And he basically hired the rhythm section of Morris, myself, and Andy. Yeah. And we joined his band. And during that time, Andy Munro, the drummer, had an accident and fell out of a window, actually, and broke his back when we were just about to go on a tour. And so a drummer, a guy called Jeff Allen, was brought in.
Yeah.
To debt for him, and after about another year, Jeff continued with that band, and Jeff said, "I'm going to reform East of Eden," because he'd been in the band.
East of Eden.
So reformed East of Eden, and I joined him in that band, and then we made three albums with that band, and toured Europe and Britain and all that sort of stuff. So, and during that period of time, I started doing a little bit of session work. For other people.
So you say meteoric, but it was quite a rise to
there was a rise. I think the reality was I wasn't making a great deal of money, but I was meeting a lot of good people who in the next few years to come were going to be very influential in giving me lots of work.
Sure, yeah. So you were touring Europe, which is quite something, but that led on to going to America, didn't it?
Yeah, well, what happened was East of Eden eventually broke up, and session work, started to take over, and I decided not to be in a band anymore as such, you know, and to be a session musician, because it was much more lucrative, and I seemed to be able to do it.
Yes.
So, that led to being hired to go to America, starting a world tour in 1978. But I went to America the very beginning of 1978, February of 1978, for the artist Leo Sayer.
Yeah.
And joined his touring band, which was to go on an association with him for sort of 25 to 30 years off and on. So that took me to Los Angeles. And now I was the youngest person in the band by a long stretch, and a lot of the older musicians much more experienced, and I got into sort of introduced to, you know, much hardcore drinking and drugging during that period of time, which I rather enjoyed.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
And so that's when it all sort of started to really take off.
And you were still relatively young, weren't you?
Yes, yeah.
How old were you?
24.
Yeah, that's so young.
Yeah.
Yeah, the drinking was increasing, Les, and your drug taking. However, you know, in that business, other people were doing the same thing, really.
Nice. Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, everybody, well, not everybody, but most people were at it in some capacity, and it wasn't frowned upon. As long as you could do your gig, that was fine. And I was definitely functioning. So, I wouldn't be on stage drunk, and I wouldn't drink until after the show, and all that sort of stuff. So, yeah, I was still functioning, and that continued for many, many years.
Many years, yeah.
Able to do that, yeah.
And all the time, you were working, more or less.
More or less working, yeah, pretty steadily. Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
You must have, come into contact with a lot of, well, pretty fantastic musicians.
Incredible musician. I was very, very lucky because it wasn't just Leo's band I worked with. I worked with a lot of other people. I worked with Shaken Stevens and worked with John Anderson from Yes for a while. And Paul Rogers, you know, who was in Bad Company and Free.
Yeah.
And Larry Siffrey and Barbara Dixon and, you know, lots and lots of different people. Yeah. The Walker Brothers and, you know, Pete Townsend did some work with, did some West End shows as well. And, yeah, I was on the list of people
that
you might think of hiring if you were looking for a guitar player,
a gun
for hire, as we used to.
But I know, having known you for some years, I know your deep love. You love all music, but is jazz, and your next selection of music is. Well,
Joe Zaminil, the keyboard player who played with Miles Davis in Silent Way, had formed a band called Weather Report. I really loved all the early Weather Report albums. Mm. And with Wayne Shorter, an amazing jazz sax player, who played with some of the greats as well. And some of the various different sort of quartets. Then suddenly this bass player appeared called Jaco Pastorius, who joined the band, and that really they made, I think, sort of three classic albums.
Mm.
And Jaco wrote a song called Teen Town, which was and still is to me one of the classic of that sort of era of jazz music.
Okay, let's play it. Yeah. Weather Report, Teen Town. Weather report with Teen Town. Pretty fantastic, yeah. By this time, Les, you were married, mm-hmm. and you have two sons.
Yes, yeah, two boys. Yeah.
Two boys.
Yeah, yeah.
Luke and Tom,
yeah.
Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah.
And
I'd just like to interject there. Tom happens to be the producer of this show, and a very fine producer he is,
yes,
as well.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. So you had a young family, and so when did things start impacting?
Well,
on them.
Yeah, I mean, I think in the late 80s, it definitely started going a bit pear-shaped, and I was started becoming aware that perhaps I was, just taking a little bit, like I said earlier, before I hadn't been drunk on stage, but a couple of times I was drunk on stage, and I was quite, I didn't feel comfortable about it,
yeah.
And it started making me question myself. But things got pretty bad, and my life got quite dark, and I split up with my first wife, and basically was still working, was still employed, but things were getting a little tougher. Quite a lot of things in my world had started becoming more difficult, I was still turning up and doing the jobs most of the time, yeah. but I probably wasn't as fit and healthy mentally, physically, and maybe even musically as I could have been. And then I met another lady, and we fell in love. That was Roberta Bobby.
Yes.
For quite a few years, things were good. Things were very good. And I sort of had a resurrection, so to speak, but then once again, things went, pear-shaped. And I eventually ended up, being thrown out by Bobby and ending up in a licensed squat in Stockwell.
That's right, yeah.
And, drinking excessively, yes. Sort of 24/7. Drugs were out of the situation by then. That's when things really started to go horribly wrong.
I'm just imagining it, really a fall from grace, wasn't it? Because it's, you were, living the high life, so to speak, in America, where you were.
And
then to have a little bed sit in Stockwell.
Yeah, well, not even a bed sit, a one
room. No, a one room.
Yeah.
And this was pretty wretched time for you, wasn't it?
Yes, very wretched time, yeah.
And how long were you there before? Because I know what the outcome was.
Yeah, about a year and a half, about that. It's all a bit of a blur.
Yeah, of course.
About a year and a half.
And then it was fortuitous.
I bumped into somebody. One day when I was going, I was still playing, still practicing, but not having any work, I must say. People had stopped employing me because I'd become unemployed. But I went to buy a packet of strings in a music shop quite a distance away from where I was living. I could have bought them around the corner, but I bought them quite several miles away and bumped into an old friend. And he could see I wasn't looking very well. I was unshaven, I was unkempt, I was, bloated, blah, blah, blah. And he said, let's go for a coffee. So we started talking, or I did a lot of talking and he did a lot of listening.
Yeah, yeah.
And then he basically, amazingly, I had no idea, he told me what had been happening to him in the last few years, and it sounded really good.
Yes, yeah.
And then he said, but but also I was had some of the problems to what you might have, you know. And he said, you know, he went to a fellowship of recovery, and you know, so he told me a little bit about that. And what happened more than anything else was it planted a seed, but it still took me another sort of 3 or 4 weeks, maybe longer, I can't even remember, before I actually investigated any form of recovery. But eventually I did. And since that point, which is now nearly 18 years ago. I've not had a drink or a drug.
I think it's remarkable. And, you know, there's a saying we use sometimes, isn't there, Les? You know, the age of miracles is with us. The fact that you went out to Surrey, I think it was, and you bought those strings in a music shop many miles away. Yeah, you could have gone up to Charing Cross Road.
Or around the corner.
Around the corner,
In Old Harbour Lane there was a music shop.
I could
have got perfectly good strings there.
But that old friend happened to be there as well.
At that moment in time,
It's absolutely remarkable.
It is remarkable.
So really, Les, it all started in Stockwell for you.
It ended and started in Stockwell.
And what an amazing journey the last 18 years have been, eh?
Incredible things have happened. Well, my second wife, Bobby, unfortunately, you know, passed away from cancer. But I was able to be there for her.
I remember.
It was not about me for the first time in my life.
No, that's right.
I was having a pity party.
Yes.
Grandchildren? Two grandchildren?
Yes, your granddad.
Yeah, I'm a granddad, Two grandchildren, Jake and Sophia, which is amazing. And you know, working with you know, various music, lots and lots of different musicians, and lots of musical situations, doing some teaching. Living I think it's I think if I hadn't had all the experiences I'd had that I have had, I might be in these sort of quieter years of my life, and that's the best way of describing it. Busy but quieter. In the sense of not flying across back and forth to America all the time and around the world. And so, you know, a more humble, quieter existence, which I prefer. But if I hadn't lived all the other stuff, maybe I would be pining for the stuff I hadn't had, but I've had all that, if you see what I mean. So I'm quite happy to be doing what I'm doing.
That's right. And you spoke about your teaching just now. I know you teach now in a guitar academy in London, but you went back to to study in university, didn't you?
Yes, I did, and I got a degree
in music.
Degree in music. That was challenging, but it was very good. The musical part of it, but the academic part of it was challenging. A lot of students find.
You've also had your fair share of obviously, you know, you spoke about Bobby. I was privileged to have met her many times. However, you also had your fair share of health issues.
I had a massive angina attack.
Yes.
I got hospitalised, which you were there.
I was there. It was the most, incredible experience. And there was that kind of, almost that dark comedy.
Yes.
Because we were in the studio. I was with Tom, son, and... then you arrived and you weren't looking too good, were you?
I wasn't feeling very well, that's right. I'm feeling unlike anything I'd felt before, ever.
We could see it was bad. And then Tom phoned
you. He made me phone the
GP. Phone the GP. So
I phoned my GP, and my GP wasn't there, but they had a locum called Dr. Curtin's.
Dr. Curtin's, which you know, in the midst of all this,
was dark humour. Yeah,
yeah.
But thankfully, he told me to go to A&E. I hadn't had a heart attack, but I had a massive angina attack. But my arteries were furred up in 12 places, and they ended up putting 7 stents in.
Yes. Yeah.
But yeah, you know, hey, you know, I mean, tomorrow morning I'm probably going to go and swim 30 lengths, and I can do that pretty much any day I want to.
Yeah, that's so, right.
Yeah, and I eat healthily. Thankfully, I stopped smoking many years before, anyway.
Yeah, that's right.
And obviously, not drinking certainly helped a huge amount.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yes. And was there anything else in that 18 years you'd like to, you know, tell the listeners, share with them, really?
You and I have gone around to various, one of the fellowships that we know about, and gone there and tried to help people with music, you know, music as a therapeutic.
Definitely, yeah.
Medicine or music medicine to help people who are perhaps in early recovery or just to help people in general.
In general. Yeah. And hopefully there'll be some more of that.
Yes, later this year. Will be. Yes,
I'm actually going to the Nelson Trust next week in Stroud. That's a very big rehab down in Gloucestershire.
Right.
But I hope to do some of that work with you later in the year.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, that's been... that's been amazing, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's been all that sort of stuff, helping other people who think, who either they have to decide whether they've got a problem or not.
Yeah, you know? Of course.
And if they feel that they have, then that's been a very useful thing to be able to do. It's been incredibly, it's like a spiritual journey, and it's been immensely spiritually satisfying and you know, giving something back, you know.
Yeah.
Because I do feel like I've had not only a second chance with the stents and that, but certainly a another chance with being able to a day at a time, you know. Not be in that dark and destructive and spiral of towards death, you know.
Yes,
that I think I was definitely on the edge of.
You know. Oh, most definitely. And as you were talking, Les, you know, I just feel that our lives, apart from the time span, but that isn't that important. You know, it's 18, it's 42 years for me, but our paths have kind of run parallel, really, in many ways. You know, I've had this last 2 years of serious health issues, but I've also, you know, done some training in certain areas of my life, and we've plus above and beyond everything else, we're so fortunate, as I said to Hugh yesterday, and he agreed that we've because of our disease, our addiction, it's put us on this path of recovery, and we've been put in touch with so many remarkable people also on the journey.
Yes. Oh, yeah, the amount of people I've met. I mean, I wouldn't have been able to have been functioning to have met so many of these really, you know, enlightened people. And ordinary people who are enlightened.
Yes.
From all walks of
life. That's right.
Who are all working towards the same goal, which really is about love, you know, in my opinion.
Yeah.
It's just about love and helping each other and just seeing that, you know, the beauty of being able to discuss and, you know, like, you know, when one has a problem, if you have a place to be able to discuss it and talk about it, it takes the power out of that, the negativity out of it.
Yes.
And I think that I didn't understand that before.
No.
I wasn't aware that it was possible to do.
That's exactly right, yeah.
So being able to do that and to feel comfortable with it and feel completely natural with being able to openly discuss my worst fears and worries and, you know, with another human being that doesn't happen to be your partner in life,
that's
or your direct family is one of the most rewarding and satisfying and nourishing things I've been able to do. So, I'm eternally grateful.
Yeah. I'd just like to share, because Les, this morning, you know, he was with one of his grandchildren, Luke's son. And, you know, Les, as he says, is a granddad, of course, and I am as well. And that's kind of quite overwhelming, isn't it?
It is, yeah. Well, I mean, I would, you know, if it hadn't been for being in recovery, and I would not be here to see them.
No.
And I wouldn't have that relationship.
That's right. That's right.
So he's, both my grandchildren have never seen me drunk.
No. No.
And a day at a time, hopefully we'll never.
They won't. No, that's right. Well, look, this has been a wonderful time with you this afternoon.
Thank you. And,
I'm really looking forward to the last choice of music because it mirrors my life. When I was 14, an older boy at the youth club took me to see Muddy Waters, the Fairfield Orchestra, and other people, Sister Rosetta Thorpe. And, and at 14, like, you know, it's kind of quite young to hear that kind of music. Mm. But like you, I was sold when I saw Muddy come on and play. And
I'd grown up listening to it all my life, and then I was lucky enough to see him and he's late 70s or early 80s.
Yeah.
Alexander Palace, there was an open air festival many, many years ago now. He performed there, and he was just in such command of the stage and the audience. One of the tunes that he used to do was Going Back to Louisiana. So that's my choice. Quite an early Muddy Waters song. So, I'd like the program to end with that, please.
That's a great ending. Les, thank you very much for this interview, and just wish you well one day at a time. And let's play out with the late, great Muddy Waters, Going to Louisiana.
Down in Louisiana, baby, behind the sun. I'm going down in Louisiana, honey, behind the sun. You know, I just find out my trouble just begun. I'm going down in New Orleans, get me a mojo hand. Down in New Orleans, get me a mojo hang.
Oh, take me with you, man, when you go.
I'm gonna show all you good looking women just how to treat your man.
Let's go back to New Orleans, boys.
Thank you for listening, everyone, and join me next time.
Here's the number of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is a fellowship for anyone who has a drinking problem. The number is 0800 917 7650. That's 0800 917 7650. The number of Narcotics Anonymous, this is a fellowship for anyone who has a drug problem. That's from 10 a.m. till midnight. The number is 0300 999 1212. 0300 999 1212. And finally, Al-Anon, which is a fellowship to support family and friends of the alcoholic. It's from 10 a.m. till 10 p.m. The number is 0207 403 0888. That's 0207 403 0888.